Bill 2474. Call Representative Tom Butler, who has another appointment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Tom Butler from House District 60 in southeastern Oregon. You'll see me around the Capitol continuing to wear my hat that says beef, it's what for dinner, and eat more beef. I'm doing this in honor of my constituents in southeastern Oregon. As employment continues to be a major issue in southeastern Oregon, my constituents are left with basically the beef industry to assist them, and particularly in Harney County, where I represent 131,000 head of cattle. So, and 131,000 head of cattle can't be wrong. So,
Madam Chair, and how many people?
Nearly 8,000, Representative Merkley.
Colleagues certainly wouldn't want to be in front of them when they had their mind made up.
No. thank you very much, Madam Chair. That's absolutely correct. I bring you today House Bill 2474, which I have brought on behalf of constituent Janann Ellis, and she's here today with her attorney, and they have some questions and some concerns relative to state law that that this bill would allow a little bit longer time to make appeals. I was just relating to my constituent a recent experience with the Department of Revenue when I was asked in an audit for a client in southeastern Oregon, when the Department of Revenue auditor that I was talking to in Salem said, well, is that something you could just dropped by my office this afternoon on your way home from work? And I said, well, I said, it would probably be easier for you just to swing by my office and pick it up on your way home from work. They said, well, where is Ontario exactly? And so with that, I want you to know that that mail service is sometimes a great problem. And when we have these 10-day times that that notice must be returned, that's 10 days from the time it's mailed from Salem. There's many times that does not arrive until the 8th or the 9th day. I've been caught on this myself many a time. Many departments in the state of Oregon do not recognize either a franking stamp or a stamp from a post office in eastern Oregon or in other parts of the state. And the mail sometimes is just bad. And I have relied upon the mail. I've relied upon other types of services to get mail to the Capitol. I've been excluded now, and others of my constituents have been excluded from the state voter's manual and the local voter's manual as a result of the fact that it takes so long for mail to go from Ontario, which incidentally is called drop loose, I think, from Ontario to Boise. At Boise, it's put on a facility where it goes to Portland, or I'm sorry, to Salt Lake, then it's rerouted back to Portland, and then it comes back to Salem. So it travels a distance of well over 1,000 miles in order to, and that's assuming that everything works fine. If it isn't properly sorted by the time that it hits Boise, then it does not go to Portland. It goes somewhere in the Midwest, I think Chicago, at which point then it's rerouted back to Portland. So this whole mail system in the state, within the state of Oregon, frequently will tease each other about the fact that if you don't get it on the right stagecoach, it won't go out on any stagecoach in some of my areas. And please recognize also that in some of the remote areas, such as down at French Glen or Diamond or Denial or Rome, those places in southern Oregon, they don't have daily service, and sometimes they're very fortunate to come out and pick up their mail once a week at the local postal service, which is in some cases over 100 miles distant. And that being the case, a 10-day notice is really not appropriate, because by the time that it's opened and any response can be given, it's many times 20 days from just the time that the response is posted back. And so this bill asks for a couple of things. That is, that these kinds of notices given by the state of Oregon be given a full 30 days, and then that we recognize postal stamps as opposed to disallowing anything because it hasn't arrived back in the various state offices on the 10-day turnaround that they expected it from the time that their letter went out. And this is not unique to rural Oregon. It happens right here in Salem as well, and chair members of the committee. With that, I thank you for the opportunity of testifying before you on this particular matter, and beg that you would see this our way and make some changes in the statute.
Well, very interesting. Questions for Representative Butler. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The way this is written now, it doesn't really address the question of appeals being faxed or other technology. Under current practice, are people able to appeal via fax, or they have to has to be mailed?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, it's my understanding that, faxes are a suitable method, and there is an attorney present on behalf of Ms. Ellis and others who have this difficulty, but also recognize that that technology does not reside in many areas of the state. Particularly, I have areas of the state that I serve that only have cell service, and that fax service is not available to those folks. It's because they can catch a cell signal for over 100 miles.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Butler. And I will call Janann Ellis, Malheur County and Clark County, Washington. And Judy Snyder is coming up with her. She's the attorney for Multnomah County. Is that correct?
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. Do you want me to proceed?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Judy Snyder. I'm an attorney from Portland, and I'm the attorney representing Ms. Ellis in a matter that we regrettably will now be appealing to the Court of Appeals because of precisely the dilemma that has resulted in Representative Butler requesting this amendment to the statute. I know that you're being handed my written testimony, and I hope that that hits the high points of at least the legal issues, but I would like to address the very practical issues. Representative Merkley, you're absolutely correct. There is a provision for fax delivery. It is equally correct that in my case, we were not even aware of that, and quite frankly, hadn't even looked at that as a consideration because it seemed, in my humble opinion, after 30 years of practicing law, inconceivable that mailing the documentation for purposes of filing the notice of appeal would not be accurate. It just was inconceivable. The statute as it currently exists requires that the notice of appeal be filed with the IRB in Salem within 10 days. Filed, meaning delivered to their offices. Now, practicing in Portland, it would seem to be a reasonable assumption that you could actually mail something to Salem 2 days in advance of the deadline, properly addressed with proper postage thereon, and that it would certainly be delivered within 2 days of mailing. Obviously, that assumption was incorrect. In Ms. Ellis's case, that particular document, which was mailed properly addressed and with proper postage on November 5, arrived at the IRB office on November 12. Inexplicable. If this can happen to a client who is represented by an attorney with 30 years of practice in the Portland metropolitan area, imagine the dilemma faced by state employees who work in Ontario, Baker City, Pendleton, Klamath Falls, or even less populous regions of the state, who are left with a narrow window of 10 days from the time that they receive notice of disciplinary action to find counsel, to advise their counsel of the factual issues that gave rise to their discipline, to have the attorney familiarize him or herself with the procedures and the legal standards, to prepare the necessary paperwork, and to get it delivered to the IRB office within 10 days. And that's not 10 business days, that's 10 calendar days. Any dismissal occurring on a Friday afternoon will leave the state employee in the unenviable position of no doubt having to wait a weekend pondering his or her fate, perhaps Monday morning attempting to find counsel, perhaps with good luck being able to meet with an attorney by Wednesday or Thursday of that week, and perhaps with equal good luck, perhaps finding someone who is sufficiently familiar with the statutory scheme to know that they have to get something hand-delivered to Salem within, in a matter of days, if not hours. So this bill proposes to address those practical dilemmas. It permits the filing by postage so that if you have dropped it in the mail within the statutory time period, you will have, in effect, perfected your appeal. and it likewise permits the extension of that time period for submitting the appeal. Now, once it's in the hands of the ERB, it can take months for resolution. I mean, we're not talking about a process that's being unduly delayed to final conclusion. In my view, the present statute raises severe due process considerations, because for a remedy to be meaningful, it has to be a remedy that's readily available to the people who it affects. And such a limited period of time to file a notice of appeal, and the lack of any consideration for the postage or the marking on the envelope as reflecting filing, raises serious due process considerations. Also, these proposed amendments will bring this in conformity with what at least is the standard at other levels. We have raised in the written testimony the fact that if this were a proceeding before the NLRB, for example, you would not only have a longer period of time, but you would be able to prove filing by postmark. Moreover, it is an extraordinarily short period of time and is inconsistent with the provisions of the Administrative Procedure Act, which we've addressed in the written testimony. If anyone would desire copies of portions of the Administrative Procedure Act, the Oregon Administrative Rules, or any other background material that would be assistance to you in your evaluation, I'd be happy to provide it to you after today's session, either by delivering it personally to your office, presumably by mail from my office in Portland, or by delivering it to legal counsel if you have staff counsel for this committee. Thank you.
Questions, Representative Girard?
Under current law, the 10 days, is that 10 working days, or does that all
calendar
include weekends?
Calendar days. It includes weekends.
Thank you.
Okay. Continue.
Do you have anything you want to add?
Just that I'd like to put a human face on it. And my goal is to see the laws change so that other employees do not have to face the same dilemma. And also, this law only looks forward. It doesn't do anything to help my situation at this point. And I guess that's a consideration that I would like to ask. Certainly, I had worked for the state for 25 years. I've put in long hours, often without pay for those hours. Overtime pay is not allowed for supervisors. And I've accumulated over 1,000 hours of sick leave. These are things that I'd like you to know. I have a family to support and so forth. What I would like is a fair hearing. I would like my cause to be heard. And because of this postmark, I don't get a chance for that kind of opportunity to clear my name, to be heard, to have my job back.
Questions? Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you bringing this to our attention. This is something I had not heard of before, and so it's very useful for us to know that this is the way it's working.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to call David Stittler, who's chair of the Employment Relations Board for Marion County. Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Stittler. I'm the chair of the Employment Relations Board. The Employment Relations Board is the agency that is responsible for administering the appeals process, which this bill seeks to amend. And that appeals process, for those of you who are not familiar with it, it's a limited civil service law for state employees, certain state employees, particularly those in the management service and classified employees who are not represented by labor unions. And it provides them limited rights to appeal certain kinds of personnel actions, among them disciplinary actions such as dismissal or suspension, demotion, those types of things. The law, as currently written, provides an extremely short period of time within which an employee has to perfect an appeal. And although it has not been a significant problem in terms of numbers, it has been a problem, and it creates a kind of serious difficulty and unfortunate circumstance that we've seen in the case of Ms. Ellis, where an employee of long standing is dismissed from state service, has a belief that that dismissal is unfair, has tried to file an appeal to challenge that dismissal, and because the appeal was not received in time, that person is not going to receive a hearing on the merits of her claim. And that really is patently unfair. And this bill will address the problem in two significant ways. First, by extending the period of time within which an appeal can be filed from 10 to 30 days. Under the circumstances, when you're talking about somebody who has been dismissed or subject to other significant economic discipline, they're often very upset. Most of the time, they're going to want to consult with an attorney to decide what their appeal, whether they should appeal or how they should proceed. They know for a fact that if they decide to challenge the action, the agency that took the action against them is going to be represented by an assistant attorney general, so it's largely in their best interest to seek representation themselves. And as you heard Ms. Snyder testify, it's sometimes difficult for a person to find counsel who is familiar with these kinds of employment laws, who is familiar with and willing to take on this kind of appeal in a very short period of time. And with a 10-day time period, it's very difficult for an employee to meet those kinds of circumstances. The other change, which is just as significant, is that it allows the filing to be considered as of the date of postmark rather than the date of receipt by the Employment Relations Board. And that really provides, eliminates the disparity of access to justice that exists now for people who live outside the Portland to Eugene corridor. It's much more difficult for those people. They have much less time to get their appeals perfected. And so this bill would address both of those concerns, and I think it's a good bill, and the Employment Relations Board would urge the committee's favorable support. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Merkley.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there reasons it would be inappropriate to make this law retroactive to some specific date?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not... I don't know if I'm in a really good position to comment on that. That's probably a legal question that might be better addressed by counsel for the committee as to whether or not it would be appropriate to make the bill retroactive. From the perspective of the Employment Relations Board, if the committee chooses and the legislature chooses to do that, I think that's appropriate.
Madam Chair, follow on.
Follow up.
Can you give us a ballpark sense of how many cases might arise a year under this type of appeal process?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that last year we had around 40 appeals of this type. And most of these appeals are people who have been discharged rather than some other form of economic discipline. Most of them are also employees of relatively long standing because, in my experience, employees who have less of a tie to their employment with the state are less likely to challenge the discipline. So the kinds of employees who are most likely utilize this appeal process are those with a significant number of years in.
Of those 40, do you have any sense of how many were disqualified because they were filed beyond the time period allowed? Beyond
the 10 days? Madam Representative, there were one or two other appeals that were, I think that's correct, one or two other appeals that were dismissed for being untimely, though not specifically under the kinds of circumstances that we have here. It is common that maybe 10 to 20% of appeals that are filed with the board under this provision are untimely for one reason or the other. And whether it's because they didn't get mailed and we didn't get received in time because of problems with the mail or some other reason, that it generally comes back to the fact that 10 days is a pretty darn short period of time for somebody to get this done.
Thank you. Thanks.
Further questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am more familiar with workers' comp appeals process than I am with the ERB, but is there any requirement for certified mail to be used, or is it just ordinary mail that these things come by?
Madam Chair, Representatives, there's no requirement in the statute or in our rules for certified mail. The certified will accept it any old way. We do accept fax filings, but it's difficult very often, especially for employees who want to really submit all their, get all their appeal in. These documents are often very voluminous. I mean, we'll get an appeal and it'll be 2 inches thick by the time all the supporting documents are attached. It's really not practical to fax all of that, and so delivery by mail is really the only practical way of doing it. This change would also make this law and the appeal filing period here consistent with provisions in other state statutes that recognize filings by postmark date, and also provide for a little bit longer period of time for filing.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2474. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2474. Representative Girard.
Madam Chair, I would move that House Bill 2474 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Girard has moved House Bill 2474 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I strongly support this bill. I think that to have a situation of just 10 days is really does constitute an unfair process for people who are in the system. I would certainly be open, in addition to exploring whether or not it's appropriate to implement it a year retroactively or something of that nature, given the small number of people affected and the denial of fairness to those who have recently gone through the process.
Okay. Other discussion?
I agree that this is a needed change, and I also particularly appreciate the agency coming in and acknowledging that there's a problem. I mean, it shows a good deal of flexibility and willingness to admit that things could be done better than they are, which we don't always find. So,
very true. Further comments? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Further comment, Betsy.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. Can I further comment, Madam
yes.
Chair?
Further comment. We're still before 9
okay.
o'clock.
Is the chair interested in postponing this for a couple days to see if it makes sense to apply it retroactively?
You know, my concern, Representative Merkley, would be that you could open the door to a whole lot of legal action, which I don't think is where I want to go. I think it's a good point, but I think we'd have to check and see how that would impact the system. It might be something when it gets to the Senate side they might want to explore, the drafters of the bill.
My final comment. I'd just like to say to Janann Ellis, thank you for your testimony, and I encourage you to pursue this concept of whether or not it's appropriate to have this redone retroactively amended on the Senate side.
Okay, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative
Shoffman? Aye.
Representative
Schitt?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair
Close? Well, it's aye. Motion carries, and Representative Rosenbaum will carry this.
Madam Chair, I was going to make a motion that we place this on the unanimous consent calendar. But if Diane wants to carry, then I will take back the motion.
Okay. I hit the gavel a little quick there, and next time I will look up for that motion. Representative Rosenbaum has vast knowledge in labor relations, so it might be helpful to have her answering some questions if there are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be pleased to.
Okay, I'm going to go to a work session, open a work session on House Bill 2161. And we had testimony on this bill Monday, but I'm going to have the staff have Megan refresh our memory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2161 was brought forward by the Employment Division. It allows domestic employers to file unemployment tax reports on a quarterly basis as well as an annual basis if they choose to. It's another option. And there is just testimony in support of the bill. Linda.
Is there a motion on this bill?
Madam Chair, I would move that 2161 move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Girard has moved House Bill 2161 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative
Girard?
Aye.
Representative
Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Shelford?
Aye.
Representative Chick?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Votes aye. Motion carries, and Representative Girard carried the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Close the work session. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2163 and have the staff refresh our memory on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2163, again, was brought forward by the Employment Department. It specifies the circumstances in which a hearing officer may dismiss a request for a hearing on a claim for unemployment benefits. Those circumstances are currently done and used in rule, but this gives them authority in statute. There is no opposition to the bill on Monday.
Okay, this is a longer bill. Did anybody have any questions of Megan about the bill? Okay. Is there a motion? Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, seeing no questions, I would move that we pass the floor the due pass recommendation, House Bill 2163.
House Bill 2163 has been moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative
Girard?
Aye.
Representative
Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Shelford?
Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Votes aye. Motion carries. And House Bill 2163 moves to the floor. Representative Merkley, would you carry this bill for us?
Be happy to.
Close the work session. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2439 and have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2439 allows the adoption of a rule reducing minimum required spacing for manufactured dwellings that are separated by a fire-resistant wall.
Okay, I'm going to call forward Don Miner of Oregon Manufactured Housing. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association speaking in support of House Bill 2439. Joining me is Jerry Gertzman, who's also wants to speak to this matter. This is a very simple bill.
Don, could you move the microphones over for us? Yes. Thank you.
This is a simple bill. It allows manufactured homes, zero-lot line manufactured homes, outside of manufactured home parks. Our current law allows them outside of parks. This law, the past, would allow them also inside of a park. Some years ago, there used to be a requirement that inside of parks, homes have no less than 15 feet between them. That was reduced to 10 feet to take into consideration the better construction. That law did not, though, contemplate zero lot line homes, homes that are placed immediately adjacent to each other. So this essentially brings the law inside of parks to where it is outside of parks. And that would conclude my remarks.
Question. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that I've seen in some parts of the country manufactured dwellings that are really designed as townhouses, where they're designed simply to have windows to the front, maybe a bay window, so on and so forth, and to be lined up like townhouses right next to each other. Are these being used in Oregon, and is that one of the reasons for this proposed bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, that's correct. Actually, they're starting to be built in Seattle now. up in King County area. So that is the idea behind this. It's not that essentially the homes will be freestanding units that when pushed together, placed together, will look like a double section home or maybe multiple section or multiple double section homes. They could be more than one story. But that's exactly what's contemplated here.
Thank you.
So it would be correct to say that this is because of increased technology, we can slightly amend our law to keep up with it.
Exactly, Madam Chair.
All right. Please continue.
Madam Chair, Council Members, Committee Members. My name is Jerry Dirksen. I'm a property manager specializing primarily in senior low-income parks in Lynn and Benton County. I own and manage a park in Albany and also one in Lebanon and Corvallis and Philomath. And the reason that this issue came up last summer is that we had an opportunity to build a manufactured home park that had gone into default in Lebanon. And there was 50 spaces, but the only way that could be economically developed, and we were primarily trying to develop it for low-income seniors, mostly on Social Security, was to construct build a type of structure that would accommodate two living units per space versus one. The cost of the land was such that if we put one on it, we would not qualify for the residents to get housing assistance through the HUD programs. We met with Larry Iverson in Salem, and basically we came to a screeching halt because we could not put what we considered a reasonable housing accommodation for senior citizens because of the limitations on the type of structure that we could put on the lots. So at that point, we kind of batted it around and did some restructuring of the property, which ended up not working because the setbacks and the spacing was too difficult to put single family on there. So that's the I think there's going to be a tremendous demand for senior housing as we go along. We all know what the demographics are for the nation in Oregon as well. And I would strongly urge a change because in my experience, 10 years working with seniors, there's a great demand for this type of housing. And I think it's something that we should look at seriously.
Questions, Representative Shoffley?
Thank you. This will also help us use our precious land here in Oregon more efficiently, mm-hmm. too, as far as density and as a land use as well issue as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, that's exactly correct also, that while this bill does not change the densities that are allowed in parks or by local government zoning, we often find that parks are placed in zones that allow for a greater density than can be achieved with, if each home is separated by 10 feet. And so this would allow the allowed densities to be utilized and make manufactured home parks more competitive, actually.
Representative Kitts.
Hi, Don. Would this apply to future parks, current parks? I mean, I have family that lives in parks, I'm picturing in their mind somebody coming right next to them, they would just go ballistic. How is this phased in? Is this for new parks, existing parks, new space to existing parks that's going to be zoned for this?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, this is not limited to only new parks. It can be used to redevelop existing parks. It probably wouldn't work out. I doubt that it would work that an existing home would have one of these structures put immediately adjacent to it because it wouldn't meet the firewall standards that the state is going to come up with. But you can envision a circumstance where an older park, for example, where some of the homes are old, are going to be thrown away. They're 12 feet wide or less. Currently, you can't buy such structures and replace them. So this would allow, let's say, the disposal of two existing units, the combining of their spaces, and actually would result in a greater, when you think it through, there'd be more space between that structure, the new structure coming in, and the surrounding structures.
I support the idea of using our land efficiently and applying this technology to seniors. However, my other concern is,
is what are the existing rules for, and you see some of these older parks that are not, you know, they don't have the most recent manufactured home dwellings in them. I think, you know, the ones that I speak of. What's to stop the park owner from just running through and jerking these people out of their existing homes, and then so they can, you know, in the name of efficiency and, let's be honest, more rent, because the more homes you can fit into a park, the more rent the park owner is going to collect. What's to stop something like that from happening?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, there's existing law requires that before a person, well, a person can't be forced to leave a park without cause. A park can be closed with a one-year notice and then converted to some other use already. I'm not sure that this bill really impacts that. It probably wouldn't make a lot of sense to kick a home out to replace it with one, just
would it,
to get more rent.
But would it make more sense to kick out two and replace it with six?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, this will still be governed by the local ordinances regulating density.
Okay.
So that this... that will still be the cap on the number of homes as it is currently.
Great. That gets at my question. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under the law as proposed, it still has a clause under 1B that says you may not install a manufactured dwelling closer than 5 feet from a property boundary line. In a park, you don't necessarily have a property boundary line, so that doesn't prevent you from doing... If by rule it's permitted, that doesn't prevent you from doing townhouse style, zero clearance between units construction, does it?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, it's my understanding that is the perimeter boundary line there, and that essentially serves as a buffer to the adjacent property,
Okay.
adjacent to the park.
Right. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2439. I'm going to open up work session on House Bill 2439. Is there discussion on this bill? Representative Gerard.
Madam Chair, I would move that we move House Bill 2439 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Gerard moves House Bill 2439 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I'm going to support this. I'm going to actually ask Don Miner to come into my office after this, because I have a few more questions that I'm not going to waste the committee's time. So because I support it in committee, I want to be as an undecided on the floor.
Okay. That's fair. Okay. Representative Shoffley.
Just outside of mobile homes right now, we can currently build single-attached or multi-attached homes with doing the exact same thing, building firewalls between dwellings. I have the privilege of being on City Council for 4 years, so we dealt with a lot of land use. So I'm fairly confident that Mr. Miner will be able to ease your conscience and your mind on this issue.
Oh, I'm sure he will. He does a good job normally.
Thank you. Other comments? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gerard.
Aye.
Representative
Merkley.
Aye.
Representative
Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum. Aye.
Chair
Close. Votes aye. Motion carries, and bill passes to the floor. Representative Zahner will be asked to carry this bill since he has sponsored it. Okay, I'm going to close the work session, open a work session on a public hearing on House Bill 2440, and call Don Miner forward.
For your record again, I'm Don Miner, here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association, to speak in support of House Bill 2440. This measure, if approved, would allow a person who installs a manufactured home in a jurisdiction where the local official won't inspect either underneath or on top of the home to call for an independent inspection. The way Oregon law works is that for a local government to assume any building code program, they're required to assume them all. So if they want to do electrical inspections,
They're required also to do plumbing, structural, mechanical, and manufactured dwellings. A number of jurisdictions, either through their risk management policies or other procedures, are not inspecting either the underside of the home or the top side. And when we say the underside, we mean we're on a double section home where the two pieces come together. Oftentimes they'll try and see under the home by walking around its perimeter, but they are not able to get into spaces less than a certain height, for example, 3 feet or 4 feet. Some jurisdictions, and I've given you a little chart that was prepared. It's just a real partial chart of what cities and counties do in terms of this inspection. But they won't, they may not have ladders for their people, so they can't get on top of the home to see how the roof lines are adjoined. Talk to Mr. Cross about this. While they agree that there's a problem, that this bill probably doesn't quite solve it for them. And so I guess what I'm saying is it's not going to be ready to go as is, and we'd like to work with the building officials and with the State Building Codes Division to massage this a bit so that it does work for all concerned. I guess our fundamental view is these inspections are necessary, that if there are going to be faults in the insulation manufactured homes, they come at what the industry calls the marriage line, that portion where the homes come together. Consumers pay for this inspection and they're entitled to it. And that concludes my remarks.
Questions, Representative Gruen?
Good morning, Don. How many local jurisdictions, because of the liability problems, you have any idea how many districts don't inspect, do this inspection?
Madam Chair, Representative Girard, I guess I don't know the number. I think it's a fair number, though. It's and it's a patchwork. In Linn County, the county itself will perform this inspection, but Albany won't. It's just a patchwork. The state of Oregon performs these inspections, will in fact inspect under and on top of the home. And my understanding is they carry these folding ladders in the trunks of their cars and are able to get up on top of them. But it's an important problem.
Thank you.
Don, Representative Gallego. Can you clarify for me, Don, if a municipality does not require the, do all municipalities require an inspection of sorts that just won't go on the roof or underneath? Or are there occasions where it's not a requirement? Who then is requesting or requiring the inspection that would make us need to hire another inspector?
Madam Chair, Representative, the inspections, I believe, are required by state law.
Okay.
And it's essentially the industry asking that these inspections be performed. Our goal is to have the work, to ensure that the work is done properly. The state, through a program funded by the industry, goes out and re-inspects homes after they've been inspected by local governments and finds problems. I'm sure they'd find them whether it was our product or other products. And when they find the problems, this is the area where they're most frequently found, is along the marriage line.
Well, is this inspection required for insurance purposes as well? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I don't believe so. I don't believe so.
Okay.
From our perspective, it's a quality control procedure. It's these are highly engineered products, and so they have to be put together in a special way. The rules have to be followed for them to perform as intended, and so that's more the reason. I don't know that insurance plays into it, although I suppose if the roof isn't done properly and water penetrates the structure, that there can be insurance issues as well.
Follow up. Well, and that's where I'm kind of wondering about the like the warranty issues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that the homeowner is required to have an inspection done to make sure that that marriage line above and beneath is done. Is that a protection for the manufactured home industry, or they're going to come out and do it anyway?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, we view it as a protection for both the industry and the consumer, that the manufacturer, whom I represent, has a long period of liability on these homes, and so and want every precaution taken to ensure that they are properly installed.
Very quick follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. What's that period of time that they're...
Madam Chair, I represent Geiges. We wish it was only 10 years. We think it's longer under federal law. So it's a very long period of exposure.
Over 10?
Probably. Our manufacturers believe it is, that they'll go back and fix problems in very old homes.
So you don't know how long that mm-hmm. really is?
Oh, just state law would be 10 years would be the maximum, but there are federal issues. Manufactured homes are a federally regulated product because they travel across state lines. They're required to be built to the building standards promulgated by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. They're subject to Magnuson-Moss warranty requirements, federal warranty in addition to state warranty. So there's a lot of exposure.
Yeah, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, I just want to really comment. And sometimes a simple visual inspection may avoid a lot of problems. And there's a lot of things that aren't inspected in our building world that would amaze the average person. I'm not beating up on the inspectors. I'm just saying, you know, if somebody doesn't get up on the roof and look at it, if I do a roof, nobody comes out and no one gets up and looks at that roof.
Mm-hmm.
The only time that the government will be coming into play is if there's a leak in it. Which has never happened, I might add. I don't follow up on. I don't do any risk, but I've done a few. If I don't follow up on it and I get sued, that's the only reason the government would ever come into play. So it's just a no-brainer for me to have somebody get up there, take a look, and that's still not going to make ensure that there's not a pinhole in there somewhere because you can't see everything. And get underneath and crawl out and just see if it looks good. So this is an easy one for me.
So, Representative Merkley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The goal here is to make sure that these get installed correctly. I'm wondering why the bill's constructed so that the installer themselves are hiring this person. Would it make more sense for the manufacturer to hire it or for the owner, future owner, to hire the person because of the, kind of like I'm hiring someone to inspect my own work, it could be a pretty cozy relationship.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, that's one of the changes we'd like to make is to allow at least the homeowner to call for that inspection or hire it done, and maybe even the local government or the state. In those cases where we know that the local officials are restricted from performing the inspection, that because they're charged with the duty to see this, then maybe a better way would be to require that they do it. That's something we'd like to work to solve in a work group. I agree with you exactly that one of the reasons we'd like these done is to make sure that folks don't cut corners, and so to leave it to the person who you might fear cutting a corner to call for this second inspection is probably not going to solve the problem.
Madam Chair, if I might, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association, and we believe that the industry has identified a concern that we need to address just recently. I think most of this has evolved fairly recently, and that we do have some jurisdictions because of risk management or OSHA issues no longer will allow their inspectors to climb on roofs or go underneath these buildings. Consequently, we need to find a solution. And one of the approaches that Mr. Meyer and I have talked about, BCD currently has a sort of a third-party licensing procedure. And for example, communities that can't do a turnaround of a plan review for residential projects within 10 days have to then give the contractor or owner an opportunity to select from these licensed individuals somebody could come and do their plan review for them. And those are approved. They go through a process administered by BCD that provides some uniformity and consistency, knowledge of the codes, that type of thing, which we would feel would be maybe an appropriate approach to use. Both Don and I have talked to the Building Codes Division, who I think would be willing to sit down with us and work out a recommendation then for this committee to look at.
So you intend to amend the bill, is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, we would like to work with the industry on doing that and seeing if we can't make sure that obviously the inspections do get done and done in a manner that the owner has the assurance that they were done by an appropriate inspector.
Okay. Questions for Bill? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We will then intend
thank
to
you.
See the bill at a later date.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2440. And is there anything else for the good of the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.